Thank you, Sanganista. Thank you for the invitation as well to come and speak here. I do love speaking in this shrine room. I think this is the third time I've done it. And I think Bodhisattva would say something like this as well. You just have a sense of being kind of in amongst the awakened mind, or the different representations of the awakened mind. You know, there's a thing in Buddhism about not turning your back on the Buddha. And it's almost like there's not many places where you can be in this shrine room where you're not. You know, there's just everywhere, all over. So it's it sort of feels very supportive to be here, and I'm really delighted to be giving a talk on one of these young men's retreats as well. So the thing we've been looking at is the theme of awakening the king, and as Sanganista was saying, we saw with Bodhisattva the unfolding, the unravelling of this archetype of the king. Kingliness as a quality, or bringing a quality of integration to the disparate forces within the world, within our own psychologies, as a way of bringing order, making order out of chaos. And also the aspect of kingliness, which is conferring blessing. It's giving others the confidence to be able to to grow, to move beyond where they currently are. And that's something kind of unique to the archetype of the king, to be able to do that, to empower others. So in this talk, what I want to do is explore more the question. Well, where does the king get his authority from? What is it about the king which enables him to make order out of chaos, which enables him to integrate the disintegrated or unintegrated forces in the world and our lives? Where does the king's natural authority come from? And this question has perplexed me in my own life. I used to be a trainee teacher, trainee maths teacher, and when I was in training, I had that rather embarrassing experience of my class being completely all over the place. You know, raucous, uncontrollable, and me doing everything in my power, or what little power I had, to bring them under control. And then another member of staff comes into the room, and they'll go and sit up straight, and it's like nothing had ever happened. It's like, how did they do that? You know, it really did perplex me. I didn't know how it was what it was I was doing which meant that the class wasn't behaving, and what it was that this other person had that they could just come along, and not without doing anything, sometimes just being there in the room, it could change that chaos into some kind of order. And I wonder as well, because it's not just a personal question, I wonder where in the world there are those forces of order today, where we can rely upon authority. A couple of things came to my mind, and I'd like to talk more about this, because I don't pretend to have a completely rounded view of it. But so things like political correctness. You know, I think at its best, it's trying to create harmony. You know, it's trying to make people feel at ease. It's trying to bring some order to the way humans relate to one another. Similarly, with things like health and safety. You know, so these books and box files of regulations that say, you know, when it's wet, you need to have this particular sign and announcement and so on, saying, mind your step and what have you. So again, that's coming from the perspective of, I think at its best, it's coming from perspective of wanting people to be well, wanting people to not injure themselves. And also, there's legislation. So there's the way the government passes laws so as to make society a safer place to be. So, I mean, those are three, but perhaps there are many more in the kind of wider sphere of the world which create, or at least have a desire to create order. But I think one thing about all those three is, I find myself wanting to rebel against them. You know, they don't have that that kind of intrinsic quality of authority to them. I wonder whether part of it is that they can be most often motivated by fear. You know, so the fear of offending others, or the fear of litigation, or the fear of terrorism. Yeah. And it's because of that fear. The fear factor being present, that somehow there isn't that intrinsic authority to them. It feels more like a kind of manipulation, and I resist that. Personally, I resist that. I'd be interested to know what you think about that as well later on. And there's also the quality of when fear is brought in, and I think maybe this was coming in the the trainee teacher experience. When fear is brought in, it's more the tyrant actually coming through, the archetype of the tyrant or of tyranny, which is predominating, rather than that of kingship or kingliness. Something about the king that makes you want to do what he wants you to do. Yeah, you're not being manipulated into doing that. So it has perplexed me and continues to perplex me. And as I said, I was a teacher. In fact, I did qualify as a teacher. I wasn't just a trainee teacher. I did qualify eventually. And I was a teacher, a maths teacher for 3 years, particularly in an inner city comprehensive, inner city London comprehensive. Do we have any teachers here, actually? No, okay.
Part-time
teacher, all right, yeah. Yeah, okay. So you sort of know what I'm talking about in terms of bringing a group of people together for a particular cause in the context of education. So in my first year of teaching, actually this is while I was still a trainee, I was given the year 10 bottom set maths class. They were a nice group, though they could be very volatile. Yeah, the volatile was the word. In fact, I think within the first couple of minutes of my first lesson with them, one boy, and I'm not going to say this verbatim, he claimed to have had relations with the mother of another boy. He didn't say that exactly. And this constituted what in West London was called a cuss. And to cuss someone else's mother was a very serious offence, you know, and it required immediate action. So within a couple of minutes, I had a fight on my hands. Basically, these two lads were just at each other. That was my introduction to this particular class. It did resolve itself in the end. But within this class, there were a couple of boys, Boris and Tremaine. Now, you've probably got an idea of what Boris and Tremaine look like. Yeah. They were two larger-than-life Afro-Caribbean boys. Was that what you were thinking? Maybe. I don't know. Anyway, so Tremaine was 6'5", and he was an all-London shot put record holder. Yeah, and he could also run the 100 in like 11 seconds or something. Very, very athletic guy. Yeah. Boris was just very strong, you know, he was kind of built like the proverbial outhouse. You know, he was very solidly built. So they were very athletic, and they were obviously kind of, they were used to being the dominant characters in whatever situation they were. Just their physical appearance, their physical presence created that sort of dominance. Anyway, so one day they walked into my classroom carrying badminton rackets. And as was my way, I struck up a conversation with them about badminton. I said, I'll see you play badminton. I like badminton. Would you like to have a game sometime? And Tremaine's face was a picture. It was like, you know, what if it was dismissive, basically. You know, you think you could play badminton against us? Yeah, you think, it was very sort of undermining of my perceived capacity to play badminton. But I managed to convince them that it would be entertaining, at least from their perspective. Yeah, they humoured me to play badminton with me. So we met a few mornings later at the sports hall. And I can't remember whether this was something I set up or it just happened this way, that I was on one side of the court and Boris and Tremaine were on the other side of the court. Boris was not confident in my chances. Yeah. In fact, I think the word he used, or the phrase he used, was, "Sir, we're going to murk you," which, for those of you who aren't familiar with West London parlance, means annihilate, basically. we're going to destroy you. But what they didn't know, what he didn't know, was that I was a university badminton captain. You know, I captained the university badminton team. And I also had a coaching qualification with Badminton England. Yeah, so I knew my way around a badminton court. And so we started off and warming up, having this rally going. I realised pretty soon that there was quite a gulf between my ability and their ability. So I thought I'd give them a good game, basically. So I sort of moved them around the court, got them kind of on the edge of what they could do, but no further. So they were able to return the shots and kept them going and moving around. And when it looked like they were starting to really experience fatigue, I hit an unreturnable smash. Yeah, as you would. Yeah. And Boris's face, he was stunned. Yeah, he said, "Sir, you're sick." Which means good, yeah. Just in case you didn't know, so you're sick. But then he said something which I thought was really striking. It was, he said, "Sir, can you coach me? Yeah, sir, can you coach me?" So he'd really, his perspective on, my ability at badminton, his perspective on his relationship to me completely changed in that rally. It changed from him being the kind of arrogant, confident young man, to being someone who could benefit from a coach and actually desiring to be coached. And those boys were both really receptive. Yeah, I took up through their GCSE PE. I took up the task of coaching them through their GCSE badminton, and they did very well. They did very well. They improved very quickly. And also, they brought something of this relationship with me to this rather volatile class. And as I say, they had this physical presence. And that became the backbone of that class, became the backbone of that group. And in fact, the group did very well, almost to the point where the following year, most of them got sort of moved up a set. So I wasn't teaching them anymore, unfortunately, in maths. You know, a lot of them did very well, so they were no longer in the bottom group anymore. So, yeah, I really like that story. I think you can go from it in a lot of different directions. But I think that what I want to particularly home in on today is the sort of turning point. What made the difference between the kind of dismissive arrogance? How did that turn into receptivity to order, receptivity even to my authority? And I think what it comes down to is that I knew what I was talking about. Yeah, I knew what I was doing. And it was just so obvious to them. They couldn't possibly doubt the fact that on the badminton court, I knew what I was doing. It was obvious. And I think this points to a general quality of the king. Yeah, the general quality of the king is that they command authority because they know what they're doing. The king commands authority because he knows what he's talking about. And the reason why he knows what he's talking about is because he's fully in touch with the way things are. He is fully connected with reality. And he's able to connect others to that reality. Often in the Pali Canon, when people first encounter the Buddha, they'll engage in some conversation with him, sometimes quite an antagonistic conversation, and the Buddha will win them over. And what these individuals then go on to say, and it's a bit of a stock formula, they go on to say something like this: "Marvelous, Master Gotama, marvelous, Master Gotama." It is as if Master Gotama has made upright what had been knocked over, as if he had revealed what had been hidden. It's as if he'd pointed out the way to one who had got lost, or held up a lamp in the dark so that someone with eyes can see. And this is something like that quality that Boris probably experienced in this at the end of this rally. It's like, oh, this is the way things are. This is reality. This is it. And it's as though there's a sense of rightness about that. Certainly that was my experience when I first came into contact with Buddhism. I was just sure that this was right. It just made sense. There was also a sense of kind of revelation, like it was sort of there in the background anyway, but no one had ever quite made as articulate what the Buddha had made articulate for me. You know, there's a sense of, a bit like what Buddha Siya was saying the other day about being drifting, or being like driftwood, and not really having a direction, but then a direction becoming clearer, knowing which direction in which to go. And then there's that quality of clarity as well, that there's no sort of vagueness or wooliness about the teaching of the Buddha. It is what it is, and it's able to be that because it's fully in touch with the way things are. I mean, sometimes the Buddha didn't even really have to say very much at all. Sometimes it was just his presence. It was just the presence of someone who had an unshakable grasp of reality. And that in itself was enough for people to go, wow, there's something in this. There's something in this. So that's a stock phrase that often comes up in the Pali Canon. I think it's well worth reflecting on, and particularly unpacking for yourself. Is this the way I relate to the Buddha's teaching? Now, is this something which I've experienced, and where have I experienced it, if so? And then often in the stock formula, the person goes on to say, I go for refuge. And initially I was, on reading this, because I used to read, I still do read the Pali Canon, but I used to be really into it. Initially I was a bit suspicious around this phrase, going for refuge, or I go for refuge. Somehow it seemed a bit defeatist, you know, kind of a refuge. Why do I need a refuge? You know, do I need safety? Do I need that sort of security? I'm not sure I do. I'm a man, I can hold my own, etc. And then someone pointed out to me that that actually I'm going for refuge all the time. You know, that although I have this idea of myself as being completely self-sufficient, actually I was looking for security. I was looking for safety. And often the places I was looking for safety in weren't very helpful. And the Buddhist tradition enumerates, in terms of the worldly winds, or the loka dharmas, the sort of characteristics of refuges which aren't safe, refuges which aren't the true refuge or true security. So those are so praise and criticism, fame and insignificance, pleasure and pain, and gain and loss. And I still do find myself very much being blown around by these worldly winds, you know, particularly praise and criticism. Last weekend, I I co-led an Oxford Sangha retreat, which a couple of these guys were on, which I thought was fantastic. I thought it went really, really well. And the feedback I got from people was almost, without exception, positive. You know, people had a great time. And for a number of those people, it was their first retreat, and they had a really positive experience of being on retreat. And then right at the end of the retreat, I received two criticisms of one of myself and one of the retreat more generally. And I noticed just how much, even given that weight of praise, how much those couple of criticisms just knocked me off course. You know, I was almost immediately going into either how can I resolve this criticism, you know, how can I, either how can I resolve it in future, or how can I undermine the criticism, how can I even undermine the person who's criticised me. You know, it's just, it really did just blow me around. And I think particularly with something like praise and blame, or praise and criticism, sometimes it's called praise and blame. I'm talking praise and criticism. In some ways, it's almost a characteristic of having taken responsibility for anything, that you will encounter praise and you will encounter criticism. It's almost guaranteed that some people will like what you do and other people won't like what you do. That's sort of par for the course of having acted and taken responsibility for that action. So the idea of trying to kind of manipulate the world so that I only receive praise, or I only receive pleasure or gain or fame, yeah. Well, it's just a headache. It's literally a headache, because you can't do it. The world does not conform to my desires to make it a certain way. Now, ultimately, the kind of vicissitudes of human relationships don't allow for unadulterated praise or only gain. And it's relating to those lokadharmas, to those worldly winds, as seeing that, trying to make praise, trying to make gain, trying to make fame, and so on, it's sort of out of kilter with the way things are. It's not real. It can't be made real because so much of it is out of my control. So much of it isn't amenable to my desires. So what is it then which is the safe refuge? What is it which does bring security? Well, I think one way of summarising this is just saying reality. And this goes back to the principle of where the authority and the king comes from. It's making as our taking as our refuge the way things are. It's orienting ourselves to reality, and that's basically what Buddhists go for refuge to. It's reality. If you're ever in doubt as to whether you're a Buddhist or not, that's your litmus test. You know, where do you seek security? Do you seek security in the stories you tell yourself? Or in gaining praise and honour from others, or do you seek it in trying to really penetrate to the core of what reality is, trying to unpack and unravel what the truth of the situation is? This is the litmus test. This is what makes one a Buddhist. In my opinion. But reality is somewhat nebulous. One can say sort of reality, but then what is reality? In many ways, the more I try to go to the core of what is really going on, the less sure I am of what's really going on. You know, when I start to look more and more closely at my experience, what I find is that the ordinary concepts that I use to sort of get around in the world they somehow don't apply anymore. They're too crude or they're too coarse. They don't really carve reality at the joints, to use a rather un-Buddhist expression. So we need something more accessible than just reality with a capital R to go for refuge to. And this is where the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha really come in. Because it's putting up an ideal which is, well, ideals which are so intimately connected with reality, but which nevertheless we are able to access. So in the case of the Buddha, you have someone who embodies that relationship with reality, who embodies that unshakability, that unruffleability with respect to the way things are. And one element I think of in terms of my own going for refuge to the Buddha is how important it is to see someone as better than me, to see someone as someone that I can look up to in a positive way, someone who has done what I aspire to do, someone who actually makes possible, therefore, for me to realise my own potential and to realise that relationship with the reality that I want. And then there's the Dharma as well. So the Dharma, not just as the teachings of the Buddha, though those are very important, but the principles which lead to reality, which lead to an awakening to the way things are. And I think the way the Dharma is articulated, I just find it helpful, and different formulations help me in different ways. At the moment, I'm thinking a lot about the five great aspects of the Dharma life. This has in many ways been a theme for me for the last year or so, year or more actually. So there's five great aspects. So in the sense of, well, first of all, developing a fit mind. Developing a mind which is together, which has in itself that quality of orderliness, that quality of integration. But also a mind which is energetic. A mind which is able to apply that energy in a directed way, in an intelligent way. A mind which is which is creative, which is able to respond to the situation as it arises. A mind which is interested in others, which is aware of others, and is able to bring on board all that energy that it has in order to benefit those others. So those are the great stages or the great aspects of integration and positive emotion. But then on the basis of that, and in tandem with that, seeing through the limitations that we bring to our experience of ourselves, seeing through the limitations that we impose between ourselves and the way things are, those assumptions that we have, those views. Seeing that actually to maintain those views is a kind of suffering, and that letting go of, even renouncing those views, releases further energy. And in fact, that in itself then makes possible the arising of a way of being which is no longer me doing stuff to the world, but it enables a kind of consciousness which goes beyond my own sense of agency, even something which I participate in rather than do. And all of this, those are the stages of spiritual death and spiritual rebirth, and all of this taking place within the context of a deep appreciation of beauty, of responsiveness to the world, of responsiveness to other beings and to inspiration. You know, and this is something which we can access. This is something we're doing on this retreat. It's something we're doing just by being here, actually, and imbibing the atmosphere of the Pavaloka Shrine Room. We are taking this on board. We are training ourselves in this way. But it's also not an individual concern. In some ways, to think that the outcome of the Dharma is personal attainment, it's just not to get what it's about. You're missing the point. The fruition, if you like, or this is one of the ways I sometimes see it, that the fruition of the Dharma life is community, is creating conditions in which others can then experience that relationship with reality for themselves. And not only that, but they can connect others with that experience of reality. I sometimes think that the way you can judge, if this is the right way of putting it, the way you can judge the wisdom of an individual is by, if you like, the awakening beings in their wake. So is seeing those people. So who is it that, as a result of this person, have come into a closer relationship with reality? I think that's one of the reasons why I follow Bhante Sangharakshita, because I'm just like, this guy clearly has just connected so many people with the way things are, and those people have been able to connect further people. It's like they're able to. It's the sort of rite of inspiration or something like that, the lineage of inspiration even, and to continue that. So it's not something that just ends with that person. So this is what the people who met the Buddha often said. So after the saying, marvellous Master Gotama and so on, they went for refuge to the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha. This is sort of articulating what that initial moment of, right, that's what it's like, looks like. It involves a movement, a looking for security, a looking for the safety that reality can provide. And it's that which gives the king the basis for his authority. It's that which enables the king to be the kind of person who is then able to inspire others to act in a way which brings order, which reconnects people. And then it pans out into the more everyday. It pans out after this aspiration and this inspiration. It pans out into the way we act, the way we behave, the way we live our lives. And this is a sequence of the refuges and precepts. This is exactly why we do it like this, because it has this sort of narrative of inspiration, dedication, and then action. So what I'm going to talk about in the last part of this talk is how the precepts themselves, how ethics construed in a Buddhist from a Buddhist perspective create order. They create order within ourselves and they create order within the world. One of the things I often encountered when I first started coming here was that people would talk about ethics as acting in accordance with the way things are. Perhaps you've heard that expression or that used. And that always, that perplexed me. I didn't quite get what that was. So what I'm going to try to do in the remaining part of this talk is unpack my understanding of that. So these are just some of my thoughts around how the ethical precepts do relate to the way things are. So to begin with, we have the principle of loving kindness. We have which is a principle of affirmation. In a way, it's what we were looking at in the communication exercises yesterday. It's encouraging that kind of attitude towards all who we meet. And it reflects reality. The attitude of metta reflects reality because we recognise in others the same desire that we have to be well. We recognise that there is no distinction between our desire to grow and to flourish and the desire of all other sentient beings. The most real way of relating to beings is to recognise that that is the same for all of us. We all share that. So the practice of metta bhavana particularly is looking at sort of cutting through those artificial and arbitrary distinctions we make between those beings whose life and growth and flourishing we affirm and those who we dismiss or even negate. The first precept is also about actually loving beings. You know, getting joy, experiencing joy in the joy of others, experiencing joy in the life of others. And I think this is probably one of the main sources of satisfaction for the king, is seeing their realm, their kingdom growing and flourishing, being able to facilitate that process for, their subjects. Then there's the principle of open-handed generosity. And again, this isn't so much an act as an attitude. In particular, it's an attitude of availability to what the objective needs of the situation are. A willingness to step in and do what is required in order to further the benefit of others. And I think this is, again, this is responding to reality, it's responding to the objective situation. And it's also so clear from the perspective of the people we interact with. You know, that quality of open-handedness, it's not like we're trying to get anything from it. The king isn't being a king in order to, live it up. They're doing it because they represent a principle of of helping others to grow and acting on that. I think this was one of, going back to the story with Boris and Tremaine, this was one of the things which really made the difference, because I could have been acting as a way of, sort of making a point that I was better than them or something like that, but it was so clear that actually I wanted to help them. I wasn't looking for anything necessarily personally from that. I just wanted to support them in their growth, and that comes through in the quality of open-handed generosity. It's not grasping onto anything, it's giving so as to allow that situation to grow. Then there's the principle of stillness, simplicity and contentment. And this is to do with finding satisfaction in what's going on, rather than looking for satisfaction in, fantasy. I'm going to talk about porn, partly because we don't talk about it very much, and partly because I sort of don't want to do it as well. It feels a bit edgy, so... Yeah, so I think porn comes into this, pornography comes into this, and I can feel my heart racing as well at the moment as I'm talking about this. So there was a point in my life when I used to use porn a lot, particularly in my third year of university, and other students, they'd have cigarette breaks or tea breaks, I'd have porn breaks. I'd sort of work for 20 minutes and then onto the computer, and it was very, very compulsive, very addictive. And I'm quite critical of porn. In fact, I'm very critical of porn, and the main criticism I have of it is that it's just not very satisfying. It's not satisfying. In fact, I found myself becoming less and less satisfied the more I used it. And I think this is something to do with this quality of contentment, because particularly as I compared myself, my physique, my performance, with what I was seeing, I realised actually I just don't live up to that. My own experience isn't like that. And in comparison, the reality of my situation just seemed, really just quite rubbish, quite miserable. I don't know whether this is other people's experience, but certainly it was mine. And it wasn't. I wish I could say it's something I kind of gave up, but it was more like I reached a point when I moved back into university accommodation in my fourth year. And I knew the guy who ran the college network, and I knew that he was pretty meticulous about what went on the college network. And so I just, almost out of fear, I said, no, I can't go there anymore. But as I kind of went through that period of not using porn anymore, I started to think, oh, actually, I'm beginning to enjoy sex more. Yeah, I'm even beginning to enjoy masturbation more, So it was like, okay, there was something in that relationship with the fantasy realm of porn, which was really undermining the reality of my situation. It was making me unhappy, basically. I should say that more enjoyable masturbation is not the be all and end all of stillness, simplicity, and contentment. Just for the record, in case you're wondering. Yes, but it's to do with that sort of polarization between fantasy and reality. The greater that polarity between what we desire and what is actually going on now, the greater the unsatisfactoriness we experience. Yeah, or at least that's been my experience on it. Okay, so then there's the quality of truthfulness, truthful communication. And this is pretty straightforward how this relates to reality. It's just saying the way things are. It's talking from that basis. And again, this brings a quality of order to our interactions. It encourages that sort of natural sense of authority in one, because people trust you. Yeah, people trust that you are acting out of the truth of the situation. You're not trying to conceal or manipulate the situation. And I think that, again, that's a really positive quality for the king, is that of trust. That the people within the kingdom know that they can rely upon the king. Yeah, and truthful communication just is the means to that par excellence. And then finally, there's mindfulness, clear and radiant. It's a quality of mindfulness. And I've been looking at this recently in the Oxford Sangha, the different qualities of mindfulness, because they're enumerated as well. So one aspect of it is sometimes called diligence. So an ability to be aware of what's happening as it's happening. And that comes from interest, really, interest and curiosity. So there's that element of mindfulness which is just being open to the situation, being curious, interested in that situation. Then there's mindfulness of purpose. So knowing how what we're doing relates to other things that we're doing. So knowing how, say, the ritual we do in the evenings relates to the practice of friendship, the practice of creating sangha, knowing how that relates to the sort of emotional trajectory of inspiration which leads us into practice, wholehearted practice. It's also mindfulness of what benefits us and what doesn't benefit us. What helps the situation? What hinders it? Again, the king knows this. The king knows this. Then there's the aspect of having a breadth of experience or a broadening of one's experience to take in everything that's going on. the full kind of spectrum of pleasure and pain, the richness of our sensory and even non-sensory experience. And again, the king knows this. The king has this breadth of awareness. That's what makes the king effective. That's one of the things that makes the king effective. And finally, there's this element of, I think the way the text put it is freedom from covetousness and grief with respect to the world. So really what this is looking at is a freedom from overlaying on our experience a particular story. You know, whether it's an anxious narrative about trying to get as much praise, trying to be as impressive as possible. Whether it's a kind of fantasy, you know, that we're overlaying, which is out of kilter with the way things are. But it's a quality of awareness which lets go of the agenda. It lets go of the story. It's just able to be with that experience as it is. In the pixel, only the pixel. That sort of thing. But this quality of awareness is bigger than a quality of awareness. The king doesn't just know what's going on. The king also devotes himself to what's going on. Even subordinates himself or submits himself to an order which he is facilitating rather than actually creating. The king submits himself to the mystery of reality. You could say even the majesty of reality. And it's by being in touch with the majesty of reality that the king is able to be the king. It's that the king is able to manifest in the world that quality of orderliness which is present in the way things are. The king participates in life effectively. So I'm going to end with a poem by Sangharakshita, which is called Life is King. Hour after hour, day after day, we try to grasp the ungraspable, pinpoint the unpredictable. Flowers wither when touched. Ice suddenly cracks beneath our feet. Vainly, we try to track bird flight through the sky, trace dumb fish through deep water, try to anticipate the earned smile, the soft reward. Even try to grasp our own lives. But life slips through our fingers like snow. Life cannot belong to us. We belong to life. Life is king.